From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, our War and Peace report continues with Jeremy Scahill, below the bomb in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. We'll talk with Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone about the juvenile justice bill and mental illness and Henry Hyde's moral universe, where more than time and space are warped. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Foreign ministers from the G8 nations have agreed on a peacekeeping force for Kosovo. That word comes from State Department spokesperson James Rubin. The action at a foreign ministers' meeting followed instructions to the hesitant Russian delegation, which resisted the role for NATO as part of the settlement of the 109-week conflict in the province. According to the latest word from the Kremlin, Russia may send up to 10,000 troops to Kosovo. Russian President Boris Yeltsin harshly condemned NATO's stepped-up bombing campaign in Yugoslavia today, calling it an attempt to establish a dictatorship of force. After scaling back the bombing campaign over the weekend when peace seemed near, NATO attacks escalated yesterday, and Pentagon officials say the number of bombing runs over Yugoslavia may double or even triple from the limited number that occurred while withdrawal talks with the Serbs were still going on. NATO-led peacekeepers arrested a Bosnian Serb yesterday who's accused of killing and torturing prisoners at a detention camp. NATO was preparing to transfer the man to the International Court in The Hague, Netherlands, the alliance said. He's charged with violations of the Geneva Convention and crimes against humanity. If convicted, he could be sentenced to up to life in prison. The tribunal has publicly indicted 84 Bosnian Serbs, Croats, and Muslims on war crimes charges and secretly indicted others. 25 suspects are in custody in The Hague. 7 have been convicted and 1 has been acquitted. Charges were dropped against 18 suspects and 6 died before they could be tried. A former legal advisor to Chile's foreign minister filed a lawsuit yesterday against the former dictator Augusto Pinochet, charging him with responsibility for the death of her husband and 71 others. The lawsuit follows more than 20 other suits being investigated by a Chilean judge against Pinochet, who is in detention in Britain since October, awaiting possible extradition to Spain. Carmen Hertz's husband, Carlos Berger, a lawyer and journalist, disappeared in October 1973 after being arrested in northern Chile by the so-called Death Caravan, a military squadron that roamed Chile hunting down leftists. And yesterday in Guatemala City, Western Hemisphere governments took a step toward keeping the peace by agreeing to disclose the acquisitions of conventional weapons. At the annual assembly of the Organization of American States, the 34 member nations approved without debate an agreement requiring nations to report the purchase or production of weapons such as tanks, artillery pieces, missiles, military planes, and helicopters. The agreement, sponsored by the United States and Brazil, now goes back to the member states for ratification. Texas Governor George Bush signed a bill restricting teen abortions yesterday and used the occasion to sharpen his message on the issue in advance of his first campaign swing as the Republican presidential frontrunner. Bush signed a law requiring teenage girls under 18 to tell their parents before obtaining an abortion. The measure would impose a fine on doctors or clinics that fail to ensure parents are notified before a teenager undergoes the procedure. Bush leaves this week on his first campaign tour outside Texas. He praised the bill as one of several steps that could be taken to reduce the overall number of abortions. Meanwhile, James Kopp's name and picture will now appear all over the world as one of the country's most sought-after alleged criminals. The subject of a 7-month-old international manhunt, Kopp was added yesterday to the FBI's 10 most wanted list. The anti-abortion activist's face will appear in police stations, post offices, and on the internet. Kopp has eluded authorities since the sniper slaying of Dr. Barnett Slepian, an obstetrician who performed abortions in the doctor's suburban Buffalo home on October 23rd. Meanwhile, in Austin, Texas, yesterday, two dozen protesters marked the one-year anniversary of the dragging death of an African-American man by praying at the Capitol and demanding a special session of the legislature to enact a tougher law against hate crimes. The James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Act, which would have toughened Texas's hate crimes law, died in the state Senate earlier this year. The demonstrators were particularly critical of Texas Governor George Bush for not taking a position on the bill. Democratic lawmakers have pointed to Bush's own White House ambitions as one reason the hate crimes bill failed.
Killers at Kigali must be sanitary workers. The butchers at Butare must be sanitary workers. The savages at Shatila must be sanitary workers. The beasts of Bosnia must be sanitary workers. Pram, pram, in the new world order. Like a dirty old bandage upon the festering face of humanity. The old order unravel and reveal. Old scar just a broke out in a new soul. Primeval wound that time won't heal, and in the ancient currency of blood, tribal tyrants are set to war score.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. NATO said today it's kept up the military pressure on Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic overnight, pounding his armed forces in Kosovo and infrastructure targets elsewhere in Serbia. While it waits for Milosevic to pull his forces out of Kosovo, NATO says its aircraft flew 658 sorties yesterday, of which 222 were bombing raids. NATO says it wants the Yugoslav leader to comply with the terms of the peace deal he assented to last week and withdraws forces from Kosovo, but military talks on the pullout between NATO and Yugoslav commanders in Macedonia have stalled. And as we reported in the news headlines, foreign ministers from the G8 nations have agreed on a peacekeeping force. That's what they're calling it for Kosovo. That word coming from the State Department. The action at a foreign minister's meeting followed instructions to the hesitant Russian delegation, which resisted the role for NATO as part of the settlement of the 109-week conflict in the province. According to the latest word from the Kremlin, Russia may send up to 10,000 troops to Kosovo. We're joined on the telephone right now by Jeremy Scahill, who is reporting to us from Belgrade, Yugoslavia. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
Thank you, Amy.
So can you tell us what reaction is right now in Belgrade to, one, the intensification of the air war, and to this latest news of the G8 hammering out an agreement around what they're calling a peacekeeping force for Kosovo?
Well, I can tell you that last night was a very, very quiet and serene Belgrade night until about midnight, and then the sky was completely rocked by NATO warplanes. Heavy anti-aircraft fire completely lit up the sky. I was standing outside in Belgrade and started to feel the rumble of the jets. And then a short time later, we saw large explosions in the sky, completely lit up Belgrade. And then fires and flames began to burn. And what it was is that they had hit, for the seventh time, the petrochemical plant in Pančevo, which is just a few miles northeast of Belgrade. This has very, very serious environmental questions that it raises. This is the seventh time they've hit that plant. It releases dangerous toxins into the environment, and I personally saw the flames burning well into the night until 3 or 4 in the morning. Simultaneously, NATO warplanes heavily bombed with 10 strong detonations the oil refinery in Novi Sad. It's the 15th time that they've hit this oil refinery, which lies right on the banks of the Danube River, a water supply for more than 10 million people. It was an extraordinarily intense night of bombing. It seemed to go on all night. The sky was lit up. The jets were rumbling. You saw the anti-aircraft fire, and there were repeated explosions. The sky would just light up as though it was daytime in Belgrade, when in reality it was 1 in the morning or 2 in the morning. Very, very serious attacks, Amy.
Jeremy, the latest news we have out of Cologne, Germany, 8 nations agreeing on a UN Security Council resolution authorizing a peacekeeping force for Kosovo with NATO at the core of the operation. Now, this action at the foreign minister's meeting following instructions to the, as they describe it, hesitant Russian delegation, which has resisted the role for NATO as part of the settlement of the 10-week conflict.
Exactly. And today, the official spokesperson for the federal government here, Nebojša Vujović, held a press conference. Now, Vujović was one of the key negotiators for the Yugoslav side down in Macedonia. He is currently en route to continue negotiations as we speak. But earlier today, he went on the attack against the U.S. and NATO side in those negotiations, saying that they were casting aside key components of the agreement that had already been established, saying that, in fact, it was they who were going back on already established agreements. Once again, federal government spokesperson Nebojša Vujović.
The other side is trying to undermine a point three, that international security presence should enter Kosovo and Metohija without Security Council decision, without UN mandate, to go in avoiding UN auspices, what is a clear attempt to undermine point three of a political document. We stick to that point, and we request appropriate Security Council resolution to give a mandate to the UN international presence in Kosovo and Metohija.
Now, Amy, that was spokesperson Nebojša Vujović for the federal government here in Yugoslavia, one of the key negotiators at the talks between NATO generals and Yugoslav military leaders. Now, all of this is happening in the context of very, very intense bombing, as we said before. In addition to the bombings around Belgrade and in Novi Sad, they also bombed an agricultural facility in eastern Serbia. That attack killed 4 civilians. They also killed 1 civilian at the bombing raids on Novi Sad. But beyond the immediate deaths, people are very concerned about what's going to happen to the environment here. Now, it was interesting. I went over to a press conference today of Vuk Drašković, who is called the leading opposition politician in the country. However, it is increasingly becoming clear that he is very closely linked to the Milosevic government. He served as the vice president in that government, and today he went on the attack against other opposition parties. He went on the attack against Vojislav Šešelj, the head of the radical party here, the ultra-nationalist right-wing party that has threatened to withdraw from the government if any NATO or foreign troops step foot in Kosovo. He attacked him as well as Goran Djindjic, head of the Democratic Party, another opposition group within the country. And what he attacked them about was their position on Kosovo. It was viewed as an attempt to shift the blame for the situation there from the government and from Vuk Drašković and the Milosevic coalition to these other outspoken opposition groups, which have been speaking out against Yugoslavia's, what they call Yugoslavia's capitulation to NATO's demand. Vuk Drašković.
We need, at the same time, denazification of this state, political elimination of political leaders and the standings of hatred, very often of fascism and Nazism, and based on hatred, anti-democracy, anti-European feelings. I emphasize especially the leaders of the Serbian Radical Party. I remember journalists in March this year, Vojislav Šešelj, vice president of the Republican government, made a speech, public speech, and he announced, in the case of NATO airstrikes, Albanians, many Albanians would be expelled from Kosovo. No forgiveness for this. No forgiveness for the policy of the other one, for instance, leader. He was the second man of the Democratic Party of Mr. Djindjic. 3 years ago, he promoted the policy of the Democratic Party of Mr. Djindjic. The only way to solve the problem of Muslims in Serbia could be castration of Muslims. We were forced to have a coalition together with with the party of Mr. Žižić. And we stood up against this Nazism of that man who was vice president of the Democratic Party.
Jeremy.
Yes, Amy.
Explain that last cut and his significance.
Well, what he's saying very well may be true, that some of these so-called opposition leaders have been calling for a very hardline policy toward the Kosovar Albanians. But what Vuk Drašković isn't pointing out, that he has supported consistently the policy of the Milosevic government. He was a part of that government, a very key player in that government. And what people and independent analysts here view this as is an attempt to place blame elsewhere, to place blame on those that have been outspoken against the government in the current context. Now, all of these guys, at the end of the day, are obviously allies, but there's sort of a script playing out here for a post-bombing Yugoslavia. It's viewed as a consolidation of the Milosevic government, a reorganizing of his government that would include some of the so-called opposition forces. And so what they're doing now, it seems, is to try to focus the blame away from the regime and onto some of the more publicly radical elements of that regime.
In terms of the other opposition, what you would consider the real opposition in Yugoslavia now, there was a news conference that was held a few days ago, but aside from that, are people publicly speaking?
No, they're not. I mean, they are increasingly talking about their concerns about the ethnic Albanians in Kosovo, as well as the Serbian Kosovar civilians as well, but they are not in a space where they can safely speak out at this point. As a matter of fact, Goran Djindjic, the head of the Democratic Party, which was attacked by Vuk Drašković, has a warrant out for his arrest for draft evasion during this time. Now, Pacifica also learned from military sources here that there has been a fresh call-up in Belgrade, that they have conscripted a number of other soldiers. For what reason, it is unclear at this point, but we do know that a number of people who were not previously called up have been called up within the past few days. So obviously Yugoslavia doesn't believe this is over. They are continuing to recruit military people. And the way this affects the opposition is that some opposition figures are having to face conscription themselves. Conscientious objectors fear that they are going to be hammered down on very, very hard, that they're going to be called anti-country, anti-Yugoslavia, that they're going to be anti-Serbia. And so they're very, very afraid not only to speak out, but they're afraid of what's going to happen if they are conscripted now or in the future.
Jeremy, we are also joined on the phone by Chuck Sudetic. Jeremy Scahill speaking to us from Belgrade, Yugoslavia, talking about the opposition and also talking about Vuk Drašković. We just listened to a cut of his. Chuck Sudetic is writing a book, a biography of Slobodan Milosevic, and has followed Drašković's rise as well. And Chuck Sudetic, I was wondering if you could explain how he did come to be called both opposition but was recruited by Milosevic.
Vuk Drašković can hardly be called opposition at all, and it's very difficult to have called him opposition even from the very beginning. He's a political chameleon, and in the realm of Serbian politics, you have to understand, the world of Serbian politics is a little bit different than, like, American politics. In American politics, you have political parties that are generally based around, as loosely as it may be in America today, which is, you know, pretty much a kind of one-party state with two different clubs. There's still some ideological differences between them. In Serbia, there are very few. You have basically political parties that are based upon strong men. And what Vuk Drašković did was take a moderate nationalist movement, forge it into a political party under his leadership, and now he plays with that party however he can, however he will, in order to put himself into a position, the best position that he can get in terms of power and in terms of being able to put his people into patronage positions. It's almost like a park district functions in a major American city. People who are in positions of power can put their people into patronage positions, and this enhances their power. Right now, Milosevic is the king of that hill. Vuk Drašković has blown whichever way the wind would blow for him to put himself into that kind of a position.
Well, I'd like you to stay with us, Chuck Sudetic, and also Jeremy Scahill from Belgrade, Yugoslavia, because I want to get a sense if you think that in order for Milosevic to maintain power after all of this settles, that perhaps he is positioning Vuk Drašković right at the forefront to perhaps work through him. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We're going to break for a minute for stations to identify themselves.
Sanitary workers, the beasts of Bosnia must be sanitary workers.
in the new world order. And it's the same old Cain and Abel syndrome, far more ancient than the fall of Rome. But in the new world order, a atrocity is a brand new language of barbarity. Mass murder normalized, pogrom rationalized, genocide sanitized, and the ancient cleansing. No name ethnic cleansing. And so the killers of Kigali must be sanitary workers. The butchers of Butare must be sanitary workers. The savages of Shatila must be sanitary workers. The beasts of Bosnia must be sanitary workers. Pram, pram, in the new world order.
We are talking to Chuck Sudetic, who is writing a biography of Slobodan Milosevic, and Jeremy Scahill is remaining on the line with us from Belgrade, Yugoslavia, as we talk about a post-bombing configuration of the Milosevic regime. Chuck Sudetic, what is your picture of that?
Post-bombing scenario? I think that Mr. Milosevic is seeing his last days, especially if the peace agreement goes through, NATO comes into Kosovo, and you have an outflow of Serbs as refugees from Kosovo, and also at the same time an outflow of Yugoslav army troops. I think that that kind of change, or that kind of influx of population into Serbia, is going to be the death knell for Mr. Milosevic. I cannot see how he's going to survive this. As I say, I don't have a crystal ball on my desk, so it's very difficult to predict the future in the Balkans. It's a very hazardous exercise. But given this is the strongest tremor that Mr. Milosevic has felt under his feet since he took power in 1987, and I really don't believe he's going to survive it.
Jeremy Scahill, we're going to give you a final word, and then we're going to ask if Chuck Sudetic can join us tomorrow again for Democracy Now! To give us a profile of Slobodan Milosevic and his rise, as well as the rise of his wife. Jeremy?
Know from our reporting on Nigeria, the phrase old wine in a new bottle. People talk about that with the new dictator in Nigeria, Obasanjo, and that's what people are talking about here. Many people believe that there's going to be an attempt on the part of the Milosevic government to sort of, in a minor way, rearrange the structure of the military, perhaps incorporating more police into the military ranks to build up the formal military component. But they also believe that he's going to do what he has done successfully in the past, and that is bring in some new faces that aren't really new to people here, but maybe new to the international community, and give them a more prominent role within the government. Someone like Vuk Drašković, who has been, quote-unquote, outspoken against Milosevic, hasn't really been outspoken against him on the policies that matter for the people here. They are very much viewed as allies, and so we could see a situation where Vuk Drašković once again rises to the ranks within the government. And the sort of passing the buck that happened today, blaming Vojislav Šešelj of the Radical Party for what's happened in Kosovo, as well as other forces within the country, it's a further consolidation of people that Milosevic has dealt with and wants to continue to deal with. I don't know that I necessarily agree with the sentiment that Milosevic is over here. One opposition member yesterday said that his political career began in Kosovo and it should end there. That is not the sense of people necessarily on the ground here. They believe that he's a very cunning person and that he will find a way to endure and keep his regime intact. If that means rearranging the military, he's going to do it. But people believe here that he's going to be in power for some time. And what they say is that means continued agony for the people of Yugoslavia.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation tomorrow. Jeremy Scahill joining us from Belgrade, Yugoslavia, and Chuck Sudetic, who is a former New York Times reporter, now writing a biography of Slobodan Milosevic. His earlier book is called Blood and Vengeance, One Family Story of the War in Bosnia. And thank you both for being with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we turn now to a national issue. Actually, I think you can relate national and international issues. One of the things that we talked about after the Columbine shootings is, as President Clinton was talking about, urging the parents of the nation to tell their kids to solve problems with words and not weapons. We did point out he was saying this against a backdrop of the bombing of Yugoslavia. But in the aftermath of the Columbine High School shootings, Congress has taken up legislation that'll seek to toughen sentences for juvenile offenders and introduce additional gun control provisions. The National Rifle Association is trying to build opposition to Senate-passed legislation that requires background checks for all guns bought at gun shows. But as the public focuses on the gun control debate, we're going to take a look today at a little-known aspect of the juvenile justice legislation that is now before the House. The House just reconvened this week, and it was one of the centerpieces of bills that they will be considering in this session. The issue of racial disparity in the arrest, trial, and sentencing of juveniles is what we want to take a look at. According to Justice Department figures, in nearly every state, minority youth are overrepresented in every stage of the juvenile justice system. And this is an issue that Senator Paul Wellstone has been taking up in the Senate. He opposed the Senate version of this bill. Senator Paul Wellstone, the Democrat of Minnesota, now joins us on the telephone. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Thanks, Amy. Good to be with you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Can you talk about this bill? Now, you're in the Senate, and this is a bill being taken up in the House.
Right.
But can you explain its significance?
On the issue of disproportionate minority confinement, what you were just talking about, or the overall bill?
The overall bill.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the legislation has passed the Senate pretty overwhelmingly, strong vote in favor of it. And there are some things about this juvenile justice legislation that are not so bad. I mean, some things that aren't so bad. There's a little bit more for prevention and a little bit more for there's some amendments that I introduced that I think are pretty good that deal with mental health and juvenile justice, making sure that states can use money to do a better job of identifying kids that are struggling with mental illness who probably shouldn't be incarcerated in the first place, or if they are incarcerated, making sure they get some treatment. But overall, it's still pretty heavily weighted on the punishment side and doesn't, I think, really address the question of how you get to kids before they get into trouble in a very significant way. Then there's another issue, which I think is a civil rights issue, which is has to do with what you were talking about, which is the unpleasant reality that some don't want to face up to, that, you know, we've got about a third of the kids in our country are, quote, minority, and yet close to 70% of the kids that are locked up are, quote, minority, and thus the issue of disproportionate minority confinement. And really, since about 1993, on the books, in legislation, we've had a requirement that states do a careful study of why so many kids of color are locked up and whether or not there are things that can be done to help improve the situation. This kind of core provision was taken out of this juvenile justice legislation that we've had since about 1993 that just passed the Senate. I think that is a huge step backward, and I'm hoping that on the House side, they have a couple of different pieces of legislation, they will keep in this core protection. But, I mean, each step along the way, you mentioned this, it gets worse. As you go from arrest to actually who gets locked up, the percentages get higher and higher. And to make the argument that this has nothing to do with race in America, which kids get picked up on the streets and which kids get let out on bail and which kids don't, and how probation officers view kids or what kind of sentences judges mete out, to argue this has nothing to do with race whatsoever and we shouldn't really kind of come to terms with this, it's just, as I said, sleepwalking through history. So I think we've got to do better before this bill finally passes.
I mean, it's a really important point to raise that the kind of shootings we're seeing in suburban schools involve white children, and yet what we're talking about are bills that are going to say the least, continue this trend of disproportionately incarcerating kids of color in urban centers.
Well, and it's unfortunately, these quote corrections facilities don't always correct, many times don't, and this can become kind of the gateway for a lot of kids to prison after that. And it's devastating. You know, we've got to, you know, you get to the adult statistics so that, what is it, in the state of California, I can't remember whether it's 18 to 26 or 18 to 30, you've got five times as many African-American men that are in prison than in college. I mean, you know, at the end of this century, in 1999, you've got one out of every three African-American men, young African-American men, either in prison or on parole or waiting to be sentenced. I mean, we really have to sort of ask ourselves the question, what is going on here? And there's a whole set of questions and issues and problems that need to be addressed. But I was outraged that the United States Senate took this provision that we've had in our juvenile justice legislation that really called upon states to be more accountable and basically stripped it away. And I'll tell you, the civil rights community is furious. And before it's all over, I think this is going to become a very big issue, because if you combine this with some of the other things that are going on in the Congress, having to do with stripping away protection when it comes to community reinvestment and having lending institutions invest some money back into low and moderate income communities, or how the census is taken. And I think over and over and over again, there is a kind of a racial divide here.
Senator Wellstone, are you concerned that in the push to get the juvenile justice bill through, it's going to be described as a gun control bill, and a lot of Democrats are going to be championing it?
Yeah.
When? Go ahead.
No question about it. I mean, that's why I got a lot of votes on the Senate side, because there were some gun control measures that passed, all of which are helpful, none of which are the be-all or end-all, but all of which are helpful. Plus, you know, you get to the whole question again of who's, quote, tough on crime, and it becomes a difficult piece of legislation to vote against. That's the way it was on the floor of the Senate. But I will tell you, the juvenile justice legislation is a little short on the justice part.
We're talking to Senator Paul Wellstone from Minnesota, and I know you're going to have to be going, but you just mentioned the issue of mental illness, which is an issue that you care deeply about. Yesterday, President Clinton made a major announcement about ordering federal health plans to give parity to insurance for mental illness at a first-ever White House conference on mental health, which was really led by people like Tipper Gore, the wife of the vice president, who herself suffered from mental illness from depression. Now, you and Senator Pete Domenici have introduced legislation to ensure that private health insurance companies provide the same level of coverage for mental illness as they do for other diseases. Can you talk about where that stands and where we stand today as a nation on the issue of mental health?
For sure. Well, first of all, the conference is, you know, can only be a step in the right direction. I'm glad it was held. Really, I think some credit ought to be given also to Rosalynn Carter. If you'll remember, Rosalynn Carter was, as First Lady, was just a very, very important leader in this area. Secondly, I think that I'm very optimistic. I think this Mental Health Equitable Treatment Act that I've introduced with Senator Domenici, we passed some legislation 2 years ago that was the first step, but this really goes a long ways towards ending a lot of the discrimination, where health insurance plans will cover you if you have a heart condition, but they won't cover you if you have a brain disease. And it's just really unconscionable. And I think we have a really good chance. We've got it's a consensus bill, and we've got Republicans and Democrats on it, and I think we can pass it. Though I think the insurance industry is certainly going to resist this. But I think that we've made some real progress, and mainly because, not because of people in the House or the Senate, myself included, but much more because families, individuals, women and men who have themselves struggled with mental illness in the last half a decade or maybe decade have really become a voice. I mean, people are no longer willing to accept second-class citizenship and no longer willing to be so discriminated against and so stigmatized. And it's empowerment. It's people speaking out for themselves. And I think with a good grassroots lobby, we can pass this legislation. One thing I have to say, though, this is a good piece of legislation, and it would, if it passed in the Senate and the House, it would be an important victory that would lead to the improvement of the lives of people. But, you know, the question leaves unanswered. What about all the people who have no insurance coverage? This just says that the insurance company has to treat the mental illness and the physical illness the same way, but there are 44 million people with no health insurance, including many people who are struggling with mental illness, who've been dumped out of state institutions but don't get community care. You see them among, you see them street people. Many street people are struggling with mental illness. So we still, I think, get back to the most fundamental issue of all, which is the need for universal health care coverage in our country.
You know, we just did a big national special on national health care and on universal health care. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if you think that with Hillary Rodham Clinton possibly running for Senate in New York, because whenever health care is talked about in the context of Hillary Rodham Clinton, it's talked about as the health care debacle. Do you think that we're going to see Democrats running as far away from the issue of health care and health insurance in these races because of Hillary Rodham Clinton wanting to avoid the association?
I have a part A and a part B answer. I actually don't think so. And then the part B, though, is better not. I mean, this is a front burner issue to people in our country. I mean, when I thought I could make a presidential run, speaking of healthcare, before a ruptured disc in my lower back, I found that everywhere, that if you talk to people, just among the top two or three issues they talk about are the need for decent healthcare coverage. And I think that I know Bill Bradley, who I'm supporting, is going to be making universal health care coverage a major issue. And I think people running for office, if anything, are going to have to talk about what their plan is for comprehensive health care reform. There are just too many people that fall between the cracks. People either don't have any coverage or they're underinsured or paying way more than they can afford, or they're not old enough for Medicare, or if they are, it doesn't cover prescription drug costs or catastrophic expenses, or they're not poor enough for medical assistance, or they have a health care plan, but it's high deductibles and co-pays and inadequate coverage. This is a huge issue to people. So many people are deathly afraid of just not being able to get the care that they need or their loved ones need.
And yet we're not seeing the leadership, the Democratic leadership.
No, we're not.
At all.
The health insurance industry took this issue off the table, and we need to build a good, strong citizen politics to put this back on the table.
Two last questions. One, back to the issue of mental illness and to the issue of police brutality. A piece in the paper this weekend in the New York Times about the killing 2 weeks ago in Los Angeles of Mrs. Laverne Mitchell, who was a 100-pound widow whose gradual descent into mental illness had left her living on the streets. She was shot to death by a Los Angeles police officer who had approached her with his partner on bicycle patrol to ask if the shopping cart she was pushing was stolen. And it goes on to talk about how then she was killed. But this issue that we often see in this country of how the mentally ill are dealt with, and you couple that with this epidemic of police brutality.
Yeah. Well, there are a couple. I don't want to. I think maybe I would want to de-link them for a moment. I mean, the issue of police brutality, unfortunately, stands on its own and has to be dealt with. And of course, the unfortunate thing is it takes attention away from those men and women in the law enforcement community who do such a good job. But I do think that we have. I mean, it's really kind of brutal. I mean, there are a lot of people that are, you know, living out on the streets who don't, if they had medication, were treated pharmacologically for depression or for bipolar disease, they'd be fine. I mean, that's what makes me so sad and also so angry at the same time about all this is that so much of the mental illness is diagnosable and treatable, I mean, with great effect. And yet these people they don't have any access to any care. And either they're living on the streets or we criminalize mental illness and they wind up incarcerated. So I think, you know, if the test case of a society or is you know, how we treat the most vulnerable citizens, I think we can't feel good about the status quo, and we have to do better. And not only for lofty, idealistic reasons, but the truth of the matter is for the sake of our own security, we have to make sure that we get care to people who need it.
Last question. I know you do have to go,
yeah.
But since we never get a chance to talk to you and you were talking about vulnerable citizens,
yeah.
We've been spending a lot of time talking about the war in Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask if you are concerned about Congress not giving approval, however you feel about the bombing of Yugoslavia, but not having Clinton not having congressional approval to engage in war.
I think that we should have had. And, you you know, it's sometimes was hard to break through in terms of national media coverage, but I know any number of different times I came to the floor of the Senate and said that we should be having a major discussion and a major debate and a major review of the policy across the board. I mean, some of us were calling for a pause in the bombing tied to direct negotiations a while ago. Some were wondering whether or not the bombing had moved from the purpose of just degrading military to also going after civilian infrastructure. And the question is, you know, not necessarily to the Congress to approve every bombing decision, but certainly to review the kind of criteria and the purpose of it. So I do think that there should have been, the Congress should have been much more involved, and there should have been much more discussion and debate. The one vote that we did take was the vote on whether or not to approve the airstrikes, which, by the way, I voted for because I thought that it was a certainty that Milosevic would continue to move into Kosovo and would slaughter people based upon what I had seen in Bosnia.
Do you feel we should continue now?
And that we had to try to do something to stop it. But I also don't feel that we were successful in stopping it. And then there was a whole set of other questions. I have for the last month talked about the need to focus on a diplomatic solution as the only alternative, and that's what I hope we will see, and the sooner the better, and the sooner we're able to stop the airstrikes, the better. But I think the one thing that I actually worry the most about now, there's plenty to worry about, but one of the things is the refugees. I mean, I still think that, you know, we have to understand that I think we have made a commitment to Kosovars, and it's going to be just a huge, it's going to require a real commitment of resources and support for people to be able to go back and rebuild their lives, and we need to be there for people.
Well, Senator Paul Wellstone, I want to thank you for being with us, the Democratic Senator of Minnesota. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to turn to the congressional side of our government, and we're going to take a look at one of the House leaders, Henry Hyde. Please stay with us.
Operation, operation, operation. Operation, same old right-wing multinational think tank manipulation of history, geography, and information. Operation, operation, operation. Operation, operation, out of shame generals. Still talking war and licking plates in the cafeteria. Operation Desert Dumbness. Operation Army for Hire. Operation Thieves. Still giving music awards and patting each other on the backs for stealing and imitating and appropriating. Operation, operation, operation.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. House Republican leaders are considering legislation that would restrict youth access to video games, movies, and other items containing violent and sexually explicit material. The proposal would also require record companies to put copies of song lyrics in stores so adults can check them first. The provisions are among several prepared by House Judiciary Committee Chair Henry Hyde to include in legislation cracking down on juvenile crime. The measure is expected to reach the House floor by next week and has become the focus for responding to the April shooting deaths at Columbine High School. Well, in this segment of the show, we're going to take a look at Henry Hyde. He became famous for leading the impeachment drive against President Clinton as chair of the House Judiciary Committee. And as he was investigating President Clinton, my colleagues Leslie Kane and Dennis Bernstein were investigating him. They are co-producers of Pacifica Station KPFA's daily public affairs program, Flashpoints, and they're also author of a new book called Henry Hyde's Moral Universe, Where More Than Time and Space Are Warped. I want to welcome Dennis and Leslie to Democracy Now! Dennis, why don't you start off by just telling us about Henry Hyde?
Well, Amy, We decided to write this book because Henry Hyde had set himself up as the moral arbiter of America. And really, this is a man who for the last three decades has been an extreme right, highly partisan player in terms of key policies that have brought great suffering to poor people, to people of color, to women. And it was extraordinary for us to see how this guy was given a free ride by the press. Imagine USA Today noting that Hyde, right before the impeachment hearings, quote, was too intellectually honest to throw his weight around for partisan reasons. Now, this guy is a political shark. Consider, Hyde is a man who, while he talked about the rule of law and really implored the country to pay attention to the Constitution, spent his time a decade earlier defending Oliver North. North, a man who practically made a career, a vocation of lying to Congress, the press, and the American people. Oliver North, who hired drug front companies and cartel pilots to work for the State Department and to fund the Contras. Oliver North, a man who drew up a plan for martial law to suspend the Constitution, put military governors in charge of the states and cities, and arrest hundreds of thousands of dissidents. So we thought it would be important to give some background on this man who says he loves the Constitution. And by the way, when North decided to draw up that plan for martial law just in case Nicaragua overtook the country and all the supporters, anti-Contra supporters of the Sandinistas rose up, this plan to throw the Constitution in the garbage was called prudent planning by Hyde. Nothing strange or bizarre.
Amy, he also attempted to undermine, actually did undermine the Constitution through this legislation that he was a major player on, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which was passed in 96. That does undermine the Constitution by limiting the right to habeas corpus in a very dramatic way. I don't know, maybe we can talk more about that later. But there are many examples of how this man went against the very principles that he was espousing during the impeachment process.
Leslie Kane, you're just talking about terrorism, and the FBI has just put James Kopp on its 10 most wanted list. James Kopp, who is the suspected shooter of obstetrician Dr. Barnett Slepian, the man who performed abortions and was killed upstate New York October 23rd. I'd like to talk about Henry Hyde and abortion. We know him now as the man who led the impeachment drive against President Clinton. But before that, Henry Hyde was most well known for the Hyde Amendment, which prevented poor women from getting federal funding for abortion. Can you talk about his record?
Well, I don't think people realize how severe Henry Hyde's views are on abortion. He actually speaks out about abortion clinics being equivalent to death camps. He calls abortion being equivalent to the Holocaust. He's extreme in his views. And one way this came out, and this ties into the whole issue of terrorism at home, is in his defense of a man named Joseph Scheidler, who was held liable in court for masterminding violent attacks against women and abortion clinics in April of 1998. And he is an old friend of Henry Hyde's, this man Joseph Scheidler. Henry Hyde refers to him as his hero. And Hyde showed up at the trial for Scheidler. He got on the witness stand and was a character witness for Scheidler and spoke very positively about him, said they'd been friends for 25 years. Again, he said he was his hero. And the most extraordinary thing that happened at that trial, Amy, and I'm going to read you what Henry Hyde said. He was asked on the stand, "Would you vouch for the character of the integrity of anyone who openly proclaimed that he would not obey the laws of the land?" And Henry Hyde's response was, "Absolutely, absolutely. If the law of the land is immoral and condones the killing of unborn children, I think that's heroic." So here we had the chairman of the Judiciary Committee up on the stand defending this thug's right to break the law.
And let me jump in here. The way he treated that legal process belies his professed belief in the Constitution and the rule of law. He made that like a campaign stop. That was a political rally in front of the courtroom. And then he sort of appeared waving to the people in the audience as if he was looking for votes. He did the same thing when Oliver North came on the stand around Iran-Contra. Everybody was trying to pay attention to what was going on. Where was Hyde? He was running around the halls of Congress looking for press. He was carrying a bouquet of roses. Who were those roses for? Oliver North. He was anxious to tell the press that he felt very strongly in his support for Oliver North. This is even before the hearings unfolded, and that he had some roses for Ollie's wife.
You not only talk about the issue of Iran-Contra, but you talk about the issue of Iran-Bosnia. Can you explain?
Well, Iran-Bosnia happened after Iran-Contra, and it happened during Clinton's administration. And you can see that Henry Hyde took the absolute opposite stand that he took when it was a Republican situation, when he was defending Oliver North. Here he was out to get President Clinton. So what happened was that Iran was providing arms to the Bosnians during the war because the Bosnian Muslims were so underarmed in their struggle against the Serbs. And basically, Clinton just sort of didn't object. He didn't condone or object this action. Even though there were UN sanctions against this, against arms going in, he actually did not violate the UN sanctions because there was nothing in them that required an objection of arms going in. But the bottom line is that Henry Hyde was outraged at the fact that we were allowing arms to go through Iran into Bosnia. He made every attempt he could. He set up a committee. He was given $1 million to set up this committee to bring Clinton down, to investigate, to talk to UN people. And he couldn't find anything, but he went all out to try to label Clinton a bad guy for doing this. And it was basically the absolute opposite stand that he took in Iran-Contra, where, well, go ahead, Dennis can say more.
And in Iran-Contra, when he, for instance, Hyde has Elliot Abrams on the stand. By the way, Hyde was the key, the head of the strategy to undermine the investigation into Iran-Contra. And so when he gets Elliot Abrams on the stand to talk about the illegal weapons to Iran as a way overcharge the Ayatollah, then use the difference in money to support the Contras, you've got Hyde saying, all right, so I understand that Federal Express doesn't deliver at night in Nicaragua, so you had to do a little dealing with the Ayatollah. We had to maybe bring in a few third-party countries to support a war. But we had something at stake here. We had higher interests. You know, it's not so easy to say what's right and what's wrong when we have these larger interests of state and country at stake. So essentially, on the one hand, Henry Hyde said, weapons to Iran, illegal operations, Nicaraguan. In fact, Hyde was called by Robert McFarlane. He was noted, McFarlane noted that Hyde was a bomb thrower because in a secret meeting, even before the Iran-Contra scandal broke, it was Hyde who was suggesting that they fund the Contras through, illegally through, this throws the Constitution in the garbage, through third-party countries, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Israel. And Hyde even suggested, put this in the category of separation of church and state, Hyde suggested that the opposition in Nicaragua could be funded secretly, illegally, through money, send it to the bishop down in Nicaragua, and then fund it through the Catholic Church to the Contras. That's Hyde's belief in the law.
We're talking to Dennis Bernstein and Leslie Kane, who have written the book Henry Hyde's Moral Universe, where more than time and space are warped. You were talking earlier, Leslie, about how Henry Hyde has been built up, and Dennis too, as a kind of statesman. You know, he certainly was in the mainstream papers as he took on the president and headed up the House Judiciary Committee. But you also talk about in the book, Henry Hyde's Moral Universe, the issue of executions, and particularly you look at his state. I mean, you have the 12th person who's just been released from death row last week in Hyde's home state alone in Illinois. Talk about his views on the death penalty.
Well, I'm glad you asked this question, Amy, because this is something I care a lot about, the fact that actually nationally 77 people, I guess it's 78 now with this recent person, have been released from death row who have been found innocent many, many years after they were actually sentenced. And what Henry Hyde has done in order to make his stand known in terms of the death penalty is he championed the legislation called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which was passed in 1996. He was one of the major players in getting that bill through. And what it does in terms of the death penalty part of it, it restricts the number of appeals that people can file. It restricts the time frame for appeals. It restricts the conditions under which appeals can be filed. It requests certain things like that proof of innocence must be shown before evidence can be introduced that in which somebody could have a second appeal. It gets complicated, but it makes it very difficult for people who are innocent to file any more than one appeal on their case, and it basically cuts the time in half in which an execution is actually carried out. And this is going to assure, in fact, we document one case in the book, the case of Tom Thompson, who was an innocent man who was executed in July of 1998 in California. And Henry Hyde's, this legislation, the which we call the AEDPA, which stands for the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, came into play at the end of Tom Thompson's long process. And I won't go into the details about it, but we have an example in the book of how this legislation actually led to the execution of an innocent man. And it will lead to the execution of many others, because it takes time for these people to be exonerated. As we've seen in these 78 cases, they take maybe 14, 15, 17 years before the process is allowed to take place. And this legislation is going to cut that dramatically and make it impossible.
I think, Amy, that sort of points to part of the reason that we did this book. The press really dropped the ball for the most part in Henry Hyde and his policies with the death penalty or the Hyde Amendment that cut off aid for poor women to get abortions. His structural policies, he's been very effective behind the scenes and in front of the cameras at making policy, whether it's the Hyde Amendment, the death penalty legislation, or obstructing the Iran-Contra investigation into the CIA drug connection, that has led to tremendous suffering and loss of life. Just recently, we see that there's now a class action lawsuit against the CIA for protecting drug traffickers bringing money into the U.S. I know you've done this on Democracy Now. Well, Henry Hyde, and that led to great suffering with large amounts of cocaine in poor neighborhoods around the country as a way of helping to fund the Contras. Well, Henry Hyde, little is known about the fact that during the investigation, Iran-Contra investigation in 1987, Henry Hyde undermined the initial investigation into the CIA-Contra drug connection. Hyde championed a fraudulent memo that suggested that the Iran-Contra committees did a thorough, wide-ranging investigation into Contra-CIA drug connections and found nothing. Imagine, he found nothing when the State Department was busy hiring drug cartel companies, a dozen drug trafficking pilots that worked out of El Salvador, and a whole line of traffickers. And yet Henry Hyde undermined this investigation, allowed this to occur. The great suffering that followed was unbelievable. And Henry Hyde, to this day, the only thing he got for that work in covering up that story was a medallion from the CIA, from William Webster, for great service to the CIA after Iran-Contra finished.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us, Dennis Bernstein and Leslie Kane. They are authors of Henry Hyde's Moral Universe, Where More Than Time and Space Are Warped. It's published by Common Courage Press. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, broadcast from the studios of WBAI in New York. And coming up tomorrow on Democracy Now!, a look at George W. Bush, the Texas governor and presidential aspirant. Also, the War and Peace Report.